Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and seeking inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our series on Tengrism, a religion most associated with medieval Central Asia. And in today's episode, I'm not covering one specific deity or one specific idea. I'm going to kind of do a roundup of topics that I haven't discussed very much in the season so far. And I want to start by talking about the relationship between Tengrism and other religious traditions, because one of the reasons that Tengrism seems to have been such an important part of the medieval Mongol Empire, for instance, is that it kind of blurs and overlaps with many of the other religious traditions that existed within the multicultural, multi-faith empire. So I wanted to quote from a letter written by Argun Khan, who was one of the rulers of the Ilkhanate. So from 1284 to 1291, he ruled that branch of the Mongol Empire, which basically was more in the kind of Western side. And he was notable for his contact with Europe to a greater extent than some of his predecessors. And he was a Buddhist, but he talks about Tengri in his letters, and he expresses a sort of inclusive view of Tengrism's relationship to other religious traditions. So here is an example from a letter sent to Pope Nicholas IV. They're talking about the idea that Argun might get baptized. The term used in this letter for baptism is silam. You're saying, may the Ilkhan receive silam, is legitimate. We say, we, the descendants of Genghis Khan, keeping our own proper Mongol identity, whether some receive silam or some don't, that is only for eternal Tengri to know. People who have received silam, and who, like you, have a truly honest heart and are pure, do not act against the religion and orders of the eternal Tengri, and of Misika, of the Messiah, Christ. Regarding the other peoples, those who, forgetting the eternal Tengri and disobeying him, are lying and stealing, are there not many of them? Now, you say that we have not received silam. You are offended and harbor thoughts of discontent. But if one prays to eternal Tengri and carries righteous thoughts, it is as much as if he had received silam. We have written our letter in the year of the tiger, the fifth of the new moon of the first summer month, when we were in Urumi. So here we have Argun saying that if this person prays to Tengri and carries righteous thoughts, then that's the same thing as being baptized, and that, you know, the Pope is fine by Argun because the Pope keeps Tengri, heaven, in mind, and has an honest heart, even though their religious traditions are different, and even though it's hard to argue that Argun himself is what we might call a Tengrist, or rather we might say that Argun just didn't see a conflict between his Tengrist and Buddhist beliefs. In fact, if you look at the actual calligraphy of this letter, not that I can read the language, but if you look at the calligraphy of the letter, you can see that the word for Tengri is at the top of the sentence. It's actually slightly out of the word order because Tengri, heaven, is above everything else. So that reverence for Tengri is kept even though Argun himself is only arguably a Tengrist. And we've seen this before with Chinese religion, and we've seen it with Shinto, where one can look at a religious practitioner and say that person is a Buddhist monk. But for a lot of people in different periods of Chinese history, it would be hard to look at a lay person and say that person is a Buddhist. They might participate in a wide variety of religious traditions and revere shrines or clergy from those different traditions. And this is a view of Tengrism, and I'm not saying it's the only one that happens, but it's certainly one that was very convenient for rulers like Argun, who had the responsibility of building alliances and maintaining political stability, not only within an empire that included a wide variety of different religious traditions, but also between states that had their own religious traditions. So, for example, in dealing with the Pope. Okay, next on my list, I want to talk about a poem that I've mentioned previously, but not discussed, which is the Epic of King Gesar. Gesar? I'm not really sure how it's supposed to be pronounced. Some people have said that it is based on Caesar, right? That there are rulers who take the title inspired by like contact with the Byzantine Empire. I don't really know. This is an epic poem about the eponymous hero, and it has a lot of background about like wars in heaven among the Tengri. There are various versions of it, some of which, like ones that are like in Tibetan, are much more explicitly Buddhist, others of which are less grounded in that tradition. These quotes are from a Buryat, so a Mongol version of the story, and they talk about conflict among the Tengri prior to the miraculous birth of this sort of superhero character. So we talked in the shamanism section about the 99 spirits or Tengri, the 44 Eastern and 55 Western Tengri. And here this is represented as a conflict between Khan Hormazda, which may be a deity that we would otherwise think of as Tengri, and Atai Ulan. Hormazda is the leader of the 55 Western Tengri, and Atai Ulan is the leader of the 44 Eastern ones. And they wind up having a big battle between the two sides. The two leaders of the Tengri went into combat. Jealousy and hatred began fighting together. Atai Ulan Tengri assaulted his enemy with great passion. Khan Hormazda went at him like an arrow going to its target, becoming dark as eagles, flying at each other like hawks, going at each other like two eagles, goring each other like two bull mooses. Fighting toward the south, they tore apart the southern sky. Fighting toward the north, they ripped the northern sky. This was a struggle for all time, a battle that would determine history. They grabbed each other's necks, trying to break them. Their thick white sinews were strained to the breaking point. On the great milk sea, waves were splashing on the shore. The world mountain, Humbur Ula, was trembling. The sky shook to the highest heavens. The surface of the broad earth was quaking. The first great jealousy was overflowing. The first wicked lawlessness was boiling and bubbling. Khan Hormazda Tengri and Atai Ulan Tengri, taking their strength from heaven, struggled powerfully with each other. Taking their strength from earth, they grabbed each other quickly. Khan Hormazda became exhausted and started losing strength. Atai Ulan used magical powers to protect himself. The gods of the west gave their support to Khan Hormazda. The Tengri of the east were adding morale to Atai Ulan. The protagonist is, I guess, said to be a reincarnated version of this son of Khan Hormazda Tengri, if I understand the story correctly, and here he intervenes to help his father. The red middle son of Khan Hormazda Tengri, Buke Bilikte Batar, seeing what was happening, becoming tired of waiting, summoning his life's strength, grabbed up a black spear an ell long. Throwing it, the spear lodged in the big toe of Atai Ulan's right foot, the hiding place of his Ami and Hulde souls. Khan Hormazda Tengri, drawing his silvery hard steel sword, chopped off the head of Atai Ulan Tengri. In his agony, Atai Ulan Tengri rolled his colorful eyes around 13 times, his black hair an ell long scattered across his back, his lips pressed together as his life departed. Khan Hormazda kicked the big black head of Atai Ulan Tengri. It went flying toward the earth until it disappeared. The huge black head of Atai Ulan Tengri found its place between heaven and earth. Lacking the strength to go up, it had no desire to go down. Frighteningly powerful in sorcery, possessing great magical powers, it became Arhanshutgar. It went about trying to swallow the sun and moon. And then other parts of Atai Ulan Tengri also become monsters, so taking his silvery hard steel sword, Khan Hormazda Tengri chopped off the neck of Atai Ulan Tengri. He spitted the neck on his sword, flinging it forcefully toward the earth. The neck of Atai Ulan Tengri landed in an ugly land, a poor and meager country, dried up, withered, and full of grief, a place of three marshy rivers, a place of slippery slopes, a land of evil spirits and demons, a scorching hot land, a dry world devoid of plants. It developed a body with 10,000 eyes on its back, 40,000 eyes on its chest, with a great single eye on the crown of its head, a single tooth in its mouth, able to take on many forms, transforming itself into 2,000 different forms, able to take on many appearances, metamorphosing into 1,003 different appearances. With great power in its two hands, with magical powers in its two feet, it became the demon Galnurmakan. He made the promise, from this time onward I make war and battle. Then the right arm becomes Orgoli the tiger, gobbling up all in its path. The left arm becomes the demon Sherem Minata Khan. The chest, etc., etc., etc. I really love that idea. That's something that could definitely go into another kind of fantasy campaign. The idea that all these monsters are parts of some evil god defeated during the primordial creation. That's some good stuff. It kind of surprises me, actually, that there's this heroic epic tradition that, like, I'm not saying I know everything about every culture's great heroes, but, like, I figure I have a pretty good sense of a lot of them. And I was genuinely surprised to discover that there was this, like, epic heroic tradition that I had never even heard of. Not that I didn't know that much about. You asked me to tell you a lot about the adventures of, like, Glooskap, who's a hero in the legends of various Native American nations on the east coast of North America. I couldn't tell you. You know, I don't know that much about Glooskap. I think he invented the fishing net, but at least I've heard of him. You know, he's a character in the novel The Ice Shirt. Like, I'm aware that he exists. But when I started researching this season of the podcast, King Gesar was completely new to me. And I'm just going on a translation that I found, you know, on the internet. Indeed, this is an old page. This is the old BuryatMongol.com webpage from 20 years ago, archived on the Wayback Machine, including a link to the Circle of Tengrism web ring. It's not maybe the most authoritative source, but it was hard to find translations of the Epic of King Gesar in English. My next point is about souls. So you heard that bit where Atai Ulan Tengger got stabbed in his toe, and that was the hiding place of his Ami and Hulde souls. This idea that the individual has multiple souls is pretty common in shamanism, and I guess therefore also in Tengrism. Often there are said to be three of these souls. So one, which is a soul of the flesh and blood, one, which is the soul of the bones, and one, which is a heavenly spirit. And those bone and flesh and blood spirits remain with the body after death, and then eventually they disappear, and then the immortal spirit, the third heavenly spirit, ascends. So you don't, like, immediately go to heaven when you die, but actually there's a process when those different souls leave your body. However, there are other versions of this three-soul idea in which the souls are described as fulfilling different functions. So I've also seen one which says that one of the souls is just the soul of the physical body, one of which is the soul of the dead body, and one of which, like, leaves the body and travels around. So presumably that's what, like, shamans can do. So I would say that there are different, you know, ideas behind this. This weirdly lines up with some of the stuff in D&D. Not necessarily specifically, like, in D&D you have a soul and a spirit, unless you're an elf, in which case you don't have a soul. It's a whole thing. But that idea that there are multiple souls and that they fulfill different functions is, of course, just a helpful reminder that lots of cultures thought like that, right? So in ancient Egypt, different aspects of the dead person's spirit, different souls, left their body at different times to go to different destinations after their death. You know, that was an important part of Egyptian belief about death and the afterlife. So the unitary soul is one common view of souls, but not the only one at all. So worth thinking about that if you're thinking about souls in the afterlife in your game's cosmology. Oh, I also wanted to talk about Yersub, if that's how you pronounce it. I know I talked about an earth goddess in discussing other deities of Tengrism, but Yersub, apparently, is the goddess of the world, which is not the same thing as the goddess of the earth. Based on some of the sources that I've read, there's an interesting idea, which is that Yersub could both be a deity, but also the world. So if we imagine that, like, Tengri occupies the heavens, then Yersub, or land water, I guess is what that means. So, like, the world, right? The terraqueous globe. I feel like I've described that name as being attached to a different deity earlier in this season. I'm not sure about that, but maybe I was just talking about the creation in general. Anyway, the point is that it's both the deity and the world. So there's some sense in which the deity of the created world is also the created world. Like, they are the same. And I think that's really fun. I like the idea that it's something that goes against the kind of structured cosmology of D&D, where gods are clearly human-like. Not just human-like in the sense of having, like, 10 toes and awkward marriages or whatever, but in the sense of being individuals. When I was doing my MA, one of the things that was being talked a lot about in the world, specifically of burial studies, was the idea that the individual was just one way of thinking about a human being, and that there were cultures that really didn't think about people in that way, or at least had rituals or cultural practices that expressed that idea differently. Maybe they saw humans as individuals most of the time, but there were times when they behaved as though they were individuals. You can see this even in religious practices that supposedly have an individual human person, right? So an example would be something like a saint's relics, where the saint is divided into bits, but the bits contain the complete power of the individual. So in fact, the saint is not individual at all. They are individual. They are divided. Or you see it in things like, there's a lot of talk about this prehistoric British and Irish burials, where what you see is individual bodies being excarnated and then reburied. So that is to say, you know, once the flesh is off the bones are reburied, but reburied in this way where it becomes impossible to distinguish individual skeletons within like the big pile of bones. So what you get is a mingling together of the remains such that they all form a kind of community of death, which we may think of as like, oh, these are the ancestors, not this one specific person and that one specific person, but just kind of the ancestors generally. So the idea that deities are not bounded by things like, oh, this has a specific body, a specific name, a specific identity, they transcend mortal concepts like being just one person at a time or always being the same person and not changing. Those are the kinds of things that puny mortals like you and I have to think about, but deities are well beyond that kind of stuff. So the idea that Yersub is both the universe, but the material universe anyway, and a deity, I thought was a fun idea. What if, you know, to use a D&D term, the prime material plane was a god? I thought that would be fun. This may have something to do with the way in which individual territories within the kind of like polities of the Tengrist world were seen as microcosms of the universe, that they were harmonious when the universe was harmonious, you know, when the ruler, whoever that was acting in line with the will or the rules of heaven. So yeah, these are just some different concepts that cropped up in the reading that all to me prompted interesting ideas, but were not by themselves sufficient to like have their own episode. So I thought I would bundle them together into a grab bag. It may be the case that our next episode is a similar grab bag, because there are a couple of other things that I think I'd like to talk about, or maybe we could take a look at incorporating this idea into a Central Asian influenced campaign. One of the things, should I save my rant about horse archers? I think I'm going to. When we deal with a society that is not like the ones that we think of as the default for fantasy, so the Mongols would be an example, we have a tendency to emphasize the ways in which they are different from European cultures. So what stands out for a lot of people about the Mongols is horse archers, because you get this point of conflict between European and Mongol cultures, and specifically the idea that you have these like European knights in heavy armor with lances fighting against lightly armored Mongol horsemen, you know, shooting clouds of arrows from their bows. And while that may have happened, it is also the case that armored cavalry equipped equally for shooting and close combat were an important part of all these kind of Central Asian influenced armies. Turkish ghulams or Mongol heavy horse were like a part of those armies. They weren't some bizarre idea that those people first encountered when they ran into Europeans. And furthermore, that style of, I guess I did do the horse archer rant, huh? Anyway, that style of what we might call medium cavalry, able to shoot or also fight at close quarters, was common not only in Central Asia, but in the Arab world, in the Byzantine Empire. Like, these were the norms and actually the focus solely on close quarters combat of some European cavalry, you know, which is not like even the tradition that you find in Spain necessarily or in, anyway, this kind of like multi-role cavalry was actually the norm. And we overlook it because we take as our norm, as our average, something that is actually a bit on one end of the spectrum in terms of the way that these cultures develop. And again, the multi-ethnic urban and rural empires of places like Byzantium or the Mongols or wherever were probably much more the norm. You know, they covered the majority of territory. And not to say that European nations didn't have those multicultural complexities, because of course they did, maybe not in exactly the same way. Anyway, that really is all the time that I have to talk about the mythology or history of medieval Central Asia for today. As I said, in our next episode, maybe some thoughts on a campaign framework, maybe some more grab bag bits and pieces on Tengrism. I'm going to do, I know I said last time that I would do some inter-season episodes before I started the Tengrism thing, and then I kind of jumped the gun and got started on Tengrism early. Because I have travel coming up and some other things demanding my attention, which you'll hear more about shortly, I'm definitely not going to start the new season of Patron Deities until well into March, maybe April. But what I'm going to do is just do some one-offs about different aspects of mythology. And in fact, if there's a particular thing that you think would be fun to talk about as a short subject, you know, but might not be a whole season by itself, why not leave a comment on this episode and suggest it? But anyway, that's all going to be coming up over the next few months right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.